When I was in seminary in Berkeley, California, in the mid-70s, quite fortuitously, I became student coordinator of a National Endowment for the Humanities grant on mysticism and spirituality. It provided a nice stipend and the opportunity to interact with some brilliant professors, including Robert Vella, then chairman of the sociology department at the University of California. It got me in the habit of reading Vella's books. So I was delighted years later when Bob Vella was invited and spoke to delegates at our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly. He had been asked to respond to a comprehensive survey of Unitarian Universalist congregations conducted in association with our UUA-wide Fulfilling the Promise recovenanting process around anti-racism that many of our congregations were deeply involved in at that time and pretty much ever since. The survey revealed, not surprisingly, a high premium on individualism among Unitarian Universalists across the board. Making clear at the outset his own membership in the Episcopal Church, Dr. Vella went on to affectionately critique Unitarian Universalism as being too individualistic. Indeed, in his conclusion, he suggested that ultimately we had things mixed up, that our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, should in fact be second, and that our seventh principle, respect for the interconnected web of all existence, should rather be first, that the web, not the individual, is a priori. This is an interesting idea to consider, it seems to me. Which is the ultimate value, the web or individual people, the individual soul? Last month, our music director, Eric, our interim music director, we're working on that. Save St. Patrick's Day. Eric Lane Barnes and I put together a service on the Unitarian poet E.E. Cummings. Cummings clearly comes down in favor of the individual. But Cummings' view, even among Unitarian Universalists, is not universal. So maybe Robert Vella is indeed onto something. I think that it's not really an either-or situation, and that the truth is more paradoxical. My thesis this morning is that we are part of the web, an integral part, but because we're human, we tend to forget this, forget our connection to the interdependent web and get carried away in all the 150,000 responsibilities and demands and considerations of life. Trapped in a never-ending pursuit of the future, we lose touch with the ever-present moment, become alienated and strung out, heartsick, restless, confused, basically off-center. Or as my mom would put it from time to time, feeling pretty schmoed. Well, we have all felt pretty schmoed, and one can become downright desperate, as we know. Until by some circumstance, often seemingly serendipitous, we catch ourselves, or more accurately, it seems to me, are caught by the web and reminded, literally reminded, of our connection to something bigger than our egos, in our connection, in a word, to the spirit or to source. What I want to talk about this morning are those moments, that experience of getting caught, of being reminded, of remembering, recollecting one's whole self. The experience, in other words, of breaking through. There is a Greek word for this, metanoia, which we can think of essentially as the positive experience of paranoia. Not that the universe is a conspiracy to do me in, as paranoids think, but that the universe is a conspiracy designed for my benefit, as James Joyce repeatedly makes clear if you can figure out his books. I think that's what he's trying to say. In other words, we are part of a web designed, as it were, to enlist our awe, our wonder, and our inspired efforts to become, to blossom into, the best persons we can be. We are vessels, each of us personally nuanced vessels of the web's creative power. Maybe you have had an experience that brought this home to you, an experience that suddenly brought you to your senses in spite of yourself. The 17th century mathematician Blaise Pascal did, and it changed his life. He wrote about it. It was like 2 hours. He wrote about it. He made a little pouch, a leather pouch. He strung it. He wore it over his heart day and night for the rest of his life. Plato's famous allegory of the cave describes something similar, which must have occurred to him through the influence of his mentor, Socrates. The allegory is described at length in The Republic. Of course, it's all expressed dialectically, with Socrates asking questions and Glaucon, his interlocutor, answering. But essentially, what's depicted is this, and I'll just imagine that this is not a window, but a wall, a dark wall, the back wall of a cave. The entrance to the cave is back there. But you, the people in the parable, are stuck. You can only look this way at the back wall of the cave. Now behind you, imagine a balustrade, and behind that, a bonfire. Now it happens that prison guards, you're being attended, you're in jail here, and the reason you can't move your head is because they've got you in shackles and in chains. And there's this balustrade, and there's a bonfire behind that. And it happens that the prison guards have a habit of regularly walking across that balustrade and carrying as they go large cutout figures that, with the fire behind them, cast shadows on the wall in front of the prisoners. And wouldn't you know it, the community living there in the cave, none of whom realize their predicament, end up being organized and ranked socially by virtue of who among them can most accurately predict what shadow figures are likely to appear next and what they all mean. Until one morning, one of the prisoners wakes up and finds her chains and shackles removed. Naturally, she gets up and slowly ascends from the depths of the cave, past her captors, past the balustrade, the bonfire, and on up to the light of day. Only now she realizes how misguided and constricted her former condition has been. The experience, the psychological experience, the spiritual experience of release and escape from bondage and wandering out of constrictive darkness and into daylight and freedom, such an experience clearly must have happened to Plato. Of course it happened, since basically that's what the dialogues are all about, philosophy as a means of liberation and enlightenment. Escape from psychic, emotional darkness and entrapment, and into the light and clarity of day. Now, some people plainly have had experiences of this kind, called epiphanies, super epiphanies almost, what scholars might call a hierophany, like this fellow or woman, whatever it is, I'm not sure which, on the cover of the Order of Service. I mean, they're going, wow, check it out. For others, most of us, I think, things don't happen with such a bang. The change is subtler and more gradual. Unlike St. Paul on the road to Damascus, we're not knocked off our horse. Still, there is such a thing as awakening. In the words of the late Kenneth Patton, renowned UU minister and humanist, there are moments when the sheerest and simplest sensual experience wears a golden significance. Suddenly, as the air is crystal clear after the rain, Objects take on a naked, transparent meaning. We are probed and wounded by the smooth, chill surface of glass, by a flashing sword of color, by the explosive individuality of a bird or child. We are stabbed by the isness and thatness of things. There comes a fresh and splendid sense of existence. We are shocked into self-awareness. I remember reading an essay written by one of my colleagues, Denise Tracy. Reverend Tracy had missed her plane and was in a very crummy mood, sitting alone in a faraway airport, simmering and staring blankly out the window when, slowly at first, she became entranced by an emerging scene on the tarmac outside the terminal. A group of adults were huddled, waiting. A plane came up, stairs were attached, and then a bunch of children stepped off, some carried in grown-up arms, some older ones walking by themselves. Suddenly, Denise realized what she was witnessing. Chinese children meeting, for the first time, their adoptive parents. And slowly, she began to also realize longings of her own heart captured by this scene, longings that led ultimately to adopting a child of her own. Breakthrough. I had a breakthrough of my own 19 years ago this month, walking my dog, my daughter, with, and I were living in Binghamton. She went away for the weekend. I was walking the dog, and it was cold, below freezing, and it had been for several days. And so I decided to walk over the frozen Susquehanna River and visit a deer-covered island halfway across. And Maisie, the dog, thought it was a great idea. Coming back, you guessed it, breakthrough. What was funny about it, like Denise Tracy, I'd been kind of down in the dumps at the time, sullenly walking along, head down, while brooding over this or that problem or difficulty. What about this? What about that? Oh, so many problems, Maisie. What am I ever going to do? When suddenly, I remember looking down, and there's this kind of, you could see the water. So I'm going to say, I don't remember that. And a splash into the drink, ice cold, rapidly flowing water. My daughter asked me when she got back, I was at home, I finally got home, took a warm bath, and everything. I said, God, that's the first time I've fallen in the water in 10 or 12 years. She goes, what? You did that before? And he still went out? It was stupid. But anyway, there's a curious aspect to these life threatening situations. One's other concerns sort of immediately fall away. Breakthroughs have a way of doing that, have a way, that is, of putting things in perspective. And indeed, problems notwithstanding, my immediate, unscripted, and totally unselfconscious response to that breakthrough was, life! The body automatically wills us to live. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but unlike this blown away fellow on the cover of the Order of Service, most of the time, breakthroughs are painful. Maybe not the breakthrough itself so much as the trip down the birth canal leading up to it. Experiencing a significant loss, a death, divorce, a health crisis, financial reversals, getting fired or otherwise waylaid professionally. It is so easy to exist instead of live, writes the author Anna Quinlan, describing a breakthrough experience of her own. I learned many years ago, she goes on, something really bad happened to me, something that changed my life in ways that if I had my druthers, I would never have had change at all. And what I learned from it, is what today seems to be the hardest lesson of all. I learned to love the journey, not the destination. I learned that it is not a dress rehearsal and that today is the only guarantee you get. I learned to look at all the good in the world and try to give some of it back because I believed in it completely and utterly, and I tried to do that in part by telling others what I had learned. By telling them this, consider the lilies of the field. Look at the fuzz on a baby's ear. Read in the backyard with the sun on your face. Learn to be happy. And think of life as a terminal illness, because if you do, you will live it with joy and passion as it ought to be lived. Well, you can learn to do all these things if you get a life, a real life, a full life, a professional life, yes, but another life too, a life of love and laughs and of connection to other human beings. Breakthrough. Different from Pascal's experience, different from mine, different from Denise Tracy's, but not all that different. What all these experiences of metanoia have in common, what makes them epiphanies or full-blown hierophanies, is that they break us out of our isolation and self-centeredness and into relationship. Not just smelling the rose type relationships either, between oneself and nature or products of one's imagination, but person to person, give a damn relationships with actual human beings that matter. Relationships that require investment of time and energy. And they pay back, I might add, significant dividends. Dividends that link, that connect, that heal, that remind us of our inherent worth and dignity, the first UU principle, by simultaneously making manifest, making clear, and making realized our internal connection to the web, our seventh UU principle, such that we experience ourselves simultaneously as unique individual persons and integrally connected to everyone and everything else. Breakthrough. Let me add that this dynamic applies interpersonally as well. So often in our most intimate relationships, we get stuck until some crisis forces us to look one another in the eyes and say, come on, honey, we got to break through this, followed by reaching out, helping one another off the ice if one has fallen through, back out of the torrent and onto solid ground. Communities, too, can fall into ruts of convention and self-absorption and can break through as well. Our churches can break through, and some of them have and are breaking through right onto the threshold today. From what I can tell, reading through this church's history and from talking to many of you who were here in the early years and are still here, this congregation has on several occasions gone through breakthrough periods, as you will again in the future, and maybe we are on the cusp of right now. There's a lot that needs to be attended to over the coming 5 years. Some of it will be hard, but a great deal will be fun and cause for great celebration. And now is the time. American culture, not to mention global culture, is currently in the midst of an enormous transformation. A sea change is happening right now in our midst. Some of it dangerously destructive for sure, but there is a lot going on that is wonderful, life-affirming, and uplifting to the heart and spirit if you let yourselves be part of it. Let yourselves be part of it. Let us collectively be part of it, beyond too much individualism and into relationship, into beloved community, into the interdependent web of all existence, into life, beginning again, anew, today. Spirit of life, hear our prayer. Let us break through every day. Let us lead regenerative, transformational, breakthrough lives. So may it be. Amen. Amen. Namaste.